From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what does it mean when an elected official blocks a critic on Twitter? We'll talk about the First Amendment in the age of Twitter. Plus, fewer people stepping up to serve as volunteer firefighters.
And really, the common theme with the chiefs and the members on fire departments is the same. We can't seem to find enough people, especially during the daytime.
Kalamazoo wants to take a new approach in prosecuting people who commit domestic violence, the trauma court.
Doing assessments of the perpetrators to identify those underlying issues that are causing them to be perpetrators.
Sky-high deductibles forcing hospitals to ask some to pay up front.
Now what hospitals are facing, we've reduced the number of uninsured people, but they're seeing a big increase in bad deaths from people who are underinsured.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Last week, a federal appeals court said President Trump violated the First Amendment by blocking certain critics on Twitter. Meanwhile, in Michigan, a Republican state representative called out the Democratic Attorney General for blocking him on Twitter. Here to help us understand free speech in the age of Twitter is attorney Faith Spahr. She's a University of Michigan lecturer in communication studies. Faith, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So let's recap what happened in Michigan. So we have Republican Representative Bo LaFave of Iron Mountain. He has criticized Attorney General Nessel over Line 5, over her investigation into the sexual abuse accusations against Catholic priests. And now he says, she has blocked me on Twitter. Does an elected official blocking people on this public social media account, does this violate free speech?
I'm going to give a very attorney-like answer.
It depends.
If you look at the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruling in the Knight Institute versus Trump case, one of the things that they said is it's going to be a context-by-context analysis. Whether or not the Attorney General's account, if it's private and she's doing private things from that and not making public pronouncements, that might be a different analysis than what the Second Circuit Court of Appeals indicated in the Trump case. So it depends on what she's saying from that particular private account. Is she issuing public policy pronouncements from that account? And I actually don't know for sure. I haven't looked at that account to see what she's been doing from that account.
And indeed, the spokesperson for Attorney General Nessel noted the account that Nessel blocked LaFave on is her personal Twitter, and it's not the Michigan Attorney General Twitter, which she said nobody is blocked. So I guess, you know, does an elected official deserve to have a private account?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if they are talking about what they did over the weekend with their family, if they are talking about a show they saw, if they're talking about you know, things that are really personal, I think that even the Second Circuit Court of Appeals decision would indicate that they can do that. Once they start getting into more, again, policy pronouncements, more about their public duties and so forth, then I think that she's starting to, or she or whoever the public official is starting to get into the realm of what the Second Circuit Court of Appeals held, that that would be your official account, and you have some obligations under the First Amendment to followers.
So let's talk about that. I want to get a real clear understanding on what basis this appeals court ruled that the president had violated the First Amendment.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting decision because most of it's kind of insider, you know, legalese, but it's this doctrine known as public forum doctrine. And, you know, most of the cases with respect to public forum doctrine are cases where it's government-owned property. And the question is, you know, with this government-owned property, do citizens have the right to speak from that government-owned property, right? Now, the initial case was from 1939, I think it was, and it was a public space. It was like a public park. And so these were considered traditional public fora, parks, streets, sidewalks, right? Since then, the Supreme Court has gone on to kind of expand that notion to what other kinds of properties does the government own, or even what other kind of properties does the government control. And that's kind of where we're getting to with the Twitter account that the president has. Is that an account that he controls, and has he opened it up for public discussion because people can comment and the comment thread can – the commenters can comment to one another about public issues, about things the president has said.
So think of an elected official's Twitter account as the 2019
smartphone version of that public park from the 1930s.
Exactly. I mean, that's exactly what, if you read the Second Circuit Court of Appeals decision, even if you read, there's a case a couple years ago where the Supreme Court said that North Carolina couldn't ban sex offenders from social media accounts. They talked a lot about social media accounts being today's traditional public fora. They didn't go as far to say that they were, but they likened it to that. The thing that I find interesting as a scholar that looks at these issues is that it's quite clear that that's not publicly owned property. Twitter owns that platform.
True.
Twitter could ostensibly, if they wanted to, kick any of the users off, right? That's not akin to that public park. That public park was traditionally owned by the government, right?
Could that be open to a legal challenge? Your point is, you're right, it's owned by Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. You know, most court watchers for, say, the Supreme Court would say that there has to be some sort of, or doesn't have to, but usually there has to be a split amongst the circuits for them to take a case like that. And the Second Circuit Court of Appeals has come down and said that this is public space, it's a public forum that the government official here, in this case, the president, opened up. Other circuits have said the same thing. So there's not actually a split.
Let's talk about President Trump's Twitter. He's had that account for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
So as a private citizen, he can block whoever he wants. But then the act of becoming an elected official changes that, is what this court's saying.
That's what the Second Circuit Court of Appeals said, is that yes, when I think it was 2009, he first started tweeting on Twitter. But once he was inaugurated, once he started making public policy pronouncements, once he started telling us who the next, I think it was CIA director was going to be, once he started making policy pronouncements about transgender troops, those sorts of things, then it was a public space. Not his actual tweets, the interactive space below his tweets.
Okay. The space where people are being blocked.
Exactly.
Talking theoretically here, I'm not talking about Representative Lefebvre and Attorney General Nassel, but theoretically, you dive into Twitter for a while, and you don't have to look very hard at all for examples of very hateful, misogynistic things that are being hurled at people. We can certainly think of the tweet storm that was unleashed on Sunday by the president, very clearly aimed at four Democratic congresswomen of color, including Michigan's Rashida Tlaib, and things that can be said about people. So does the constitutional right to free speech give us the right to use someone's Twitter to abuse them, basically to make it open season?
That's a really good question. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals, when they're talking about this, it was a fairly, as far as once they decided it was a public forum, it was pretty easy for them to say that the president had violated the free speech rights, because he made it clear, and the defense made it clear, that they had blocked these users because of the viewpoint that they were engaged in, that they were criticizing the president.
It wasn't the content of the president's tweets.
But they were saying, we don't like what they were saying. Mm-hmm. We don't like that they were criticizing him. But they never said it was because of how they were criticizing him, like the manner, like if they were using, profanity or you're hurling epithets or, using discriminatory language. They never said that.
Okay.
So that could be a different analysis. I'm going to block this user because they continue to engage in, profanity or haranguing with epithets. So that they left aside, that they didn't address.
Because certainly when you read comments toward the president's tweets, he gets a lot of that as well. Profane, foul mouth. There is a lot of that. So it's that climate that can happen on Twitter. And it made me wonder just where that boundary line exists between criticism and outright abuse.
Right. I mean, I hate to use the old Potter Stewart as I know it when I see it, when he made that pronouncement about, what is obscenity. But it's kind of in the eye of the beholder. I mean, there's a famous case, the Cohen case, where the guy's wearing a jacket that said, with stronger language, I don't like the draft. And the Supreme Court said that one man's profanity is another man's lyric, right? Mm-hmm. And so that you can't excise certain words from people's vocabulary in going around and policing people's speech. That was different, though, because what the government was doing there is they were actually prosecuting that man for disturbance of the peace. Okay. They weren't saying you don't have right to this particular platform. So, for instance, let's say that you have a City Hall meeting and you can come to City Hall and engage in a debate with your council members. But if you start engaging in hurling epithets at them and hurling invective at them, surely you're going to be asked to leave. And I think most people would say that would be an acceptable regulation of that particular forum. I think that's possible here, even if you say this is still a public forum, that you might have some ability to have what you call a time, place, and manner restriction when it's about the manner in which you're engaging in that speech as opposed to the viewpoint in which they're engaged in.
With this ruling from the Federal Appeals Court about the president, how do you think elected officials will be interacting with critics and with opponents on social media going forward? I guess even more broadly, how much has social media changed our understanding of what the First Amendment protects and what it does not?
Well, I think a lot of government officials are going to, if they have, any attorney in their ear at all, they're going to be sitting down thinking twice about blocking users after the Second Circuit Court of Appeals decision. They could try to make it clear that what they're doing with this space is limited, so that they could try to narrow the impact of this decision, saying that it's not a designated public forum. It's limited to talking about these particular issues, right? And then that way they could try to make the argument that if I block you, it's because you were off topic, not because of a viewpoint that you were engaged in. I've read other legal scholars that talk about the fact that they feel like once a public official uses some sort of social media platform, that they should be limited completely from blocking people. That the platform itself, such as Twitter or Facebook, should say, look, if you're a public official, you've got to take all comers because this is you engaging in your constituency. And so you don't have the ability to do what other like private users mm-hmm. would be able to do. You don't have those functionalities that other private users would have, which I think is an interesting idea. I think it's Eric Goldman that said that in one of his blog posts.
Which sounds like that would kind of shoot down that this was a private Twitter account in her name versus the Michigan Attorney General account.
Yeah. I mean, and what that would do is it would get the platform owner, Twitter, Facebook, mm-hmm. it would get them more involved in kind of managing these accounts, which they're very loath to do. They don't want to be, I know that they've taken more ownership lately of it, but they don't want to look like the publisher or, anybody that has editorial control over this content.
Fascinating stuff as we feel our way into this, into the 21st century. It's been great talking with Faith Spahr, who is a University of Michigan lecturer in communication studies, talking about media, law, policy, internet, and so much more. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
After the break, we'll find out how Michigan's addressing a shortage of volunteer firefighters. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. More and more of us have health insurance with high deductibles. At the same time, we're hearing reports of hospitals telling some patients you need to pay up front before having an operation or a procedure. A West Michigan woman was told she would have to raise $10,000 before she could be put on a heart transplant list. A man in the Lansing area had to postpone a heart procedure until he could come up with $1,100. Well, to help us understand what's going on, we welcome Marianne Udow Phillips, Director for the Center for Health and Research Transformation at the University of Michigan. Marianne, just how common is this for hospitals to insist on payment ahead of treatment?
Well, it's not common yet for hospitals to insist on payment ahead of treatment. However, it is becoming more common for hospitals to tell patients in advance of treatment what they will owe, and some hospitals are asking for that payment up front.
And why are they doing that?
This is really an example of the fact that deductibles have grown so significantly, and now what hospitals are facing, we've reduced the number of uninsured people, but they're seeing a big increase in bad debts from people who are underinsured.
Who have those really high deductibles.
Really, so the average deductible now is $1,500 for an individual. Since 2008, deductibles have increased 8 times faster than wages. So people are having a tremendously difficult time paying for those bills. They may have insurance, but still healthcare may not be affordable for them because of the deductibles. So hospitals have seen a big increase in bad debts. Since just over the past couple of years, they've gone from about $36 billion in bad debts nationally to about $38 billion in bad debts. So they're seeing the charity care, the uninsured, come down, but bad debts going up.
And we've talked about, you know, you and I go back to talking before there was the Affordable Care Act, about what it would mean to hospitals to be able to have people who had insurance because of the cost of the charity care.
That's right.
And how that improved.
That's right.
Another factor that I've seen a lot of news coverage on is the need for hospitals to be transparent about what something's going to cost.
Yes.
You see, there's news stories all over the country about people going, what did that wind up costing?
Yes.
So you could see why they're being transparent.
Yes. In fact, there are some hospitals that are arguing that this statement, when they tell patients, here's what it's going to cost you, is an attempt to be transparent, right? And they're trying to build more tools for consumers so they know what to expect in terms of the cost for care. Unfortunately, sometimes I think admissions clerks or billing clerks might interpret that a little more extremely. That seems to be what happened in the case in Lansing, where the admissions clerk interpreted that as saying, you need to pay us up front, not just we're informing you. And it can discourage people from getting care that they really need if they hear what that cost is going to be.
I guess, theoretically speaking, if a patient is told, well, you need to procure some money before we can cover you, what happens for patients who don't have the money?
Right. That's a big concern, right? So that's why we see cases where patients are saying that they're not getting the medical care that they needed. These high deductibles are clearly discouraging people from getting needed medical care. We know that copays and deductibles reduce utilization. The problem is that they reduce utilization if they're just applied across the board for things that people need as much as they do for things that might be discretionary or things that they don't really need.
So what's being looked at to fix this?
Yeah, so the big thing that's being looked at is really a concept that's been developed here at the University of Michigan by colleagues who've called it value-based insurance design, VBID. And the idea behind value-based insurance design is to say we should be varying the copays and the deductibles. So for things that are really beneficial, diabetes drugs, for example, mm-hmm. We want people to be on those drugs. They shouldn't be paying copays for those things because there's benefit long-term to keep on those drugs, right?
Right.
And Medicare actually is moving down this path. There's actually bipartisan support for this idea that health plans should be able to vary copays so that maybe there are higher copays on things that are more discretionary, where there's less evidence to show that they're needed. You know, vitamin D testing, for example, is a really questionable kind of test. Maybe those should have higher copays than things that really show that they're needed, like diabetes drugs.
So there's this idea.
Yeah.
Where's it going?
Well, it's being tested at the federal level with many Medicare Advantage plans. It's getting a lot of attention from some private payers. It's a little complicated to implement, mm-hmm. so it's not spread as much as many who advocate for this idea would hope it would. And they're hoping that at the federal level, as these tests come out from Medicare, it will demonstrate impact and more private payers will start to implement.
Doctors, we know when they take that Hippocratic oath, swear to first do no harm. Could we feasibly see doctors and hospitals turning ailing patients away because they can't afford money up front?
Well, they're not supposed to turn anybody away, certainly who needs emergency care. They're not. They're required to stabilize people who need emergency care. But, you know, in the past, before we had coverage, people were turned away if they couldn't afford the cost of care, and that certainly could happen again. And again, we know some providers and are asking for some payments up front and are turning patients away if they can't make those payments. So it is a concern.
And as we see, you know, further efforts to do away with the Affordable Care Act.
Yes.
That's going to blow the whole thing up again.
Well, this current lawsuit that's happening in Texas, and, you know, there just have been oral arguments about that lawsuit, you know, that throws everything up in the air. You know, the other things that are happening on the ground are these issues around surprise medical bills, where somebody goes to a provider they think is in network, and then they find out they're not, and they get a big bill after the fact. And there's actually legislative action that's happening to try to address those kinds of situations. I think as these copays and deductibles go up, up. And I sort of think we might be at the maximum. We're going to start to see some legislative action that tries to protect consumers so that they're not being asked for funds up front, so that they do get the really critically needed medical care. They're not putting their health in jeopardy. It would not surprise me to see legislators starting to step in and look at this issue, just like they are at these surprise medical bills these days.
And when that happens, you'll come back and you'll explain it all to us.
We will. Absolutely.
All right. Marianne Udall Phillips, who's director of the Center for Health and Research Transformation at the University of Michigan. Thank you.
It's great to be here, Cindy. Great to see you.
Volunteer firefighting has a very long history in this country. In fact, Benjamin Franklin founded the first volunteer fire department in Philadelphia in 1736. But here we are in 2019, and this nation is struggling with a shortage of volunteer firefighters, with some departments being forced to cut services. We wondered what this looks like in Michigan. So for that, we turn to Lieutenant Michael McLear, who's president of the Michigan State Firemen's Association. So, Lieutenant, nationally, we've seen a 5% overall decrease in volunteer firefighters since the 1980s, but that's nationally. And some states are seeing big, big declines. What are we seeing in Michigan?
Well, we're seeing the same problem here in Michigan, too. It's harder for us to recruit volunteers because of all of the different constraints that are now facing families. We have two-income families, families that are raising both their children and their parents, and the difficulty in balancing it all today. Our call volumes continue to increase throughout the state and across the country. But what we've been able to do is we've really been able to collaborate locally through the state and also nationally to be able to pool resources. And we've come up with a fabulous opportunity to be able to connect those needs and resources with a website called makemeafirefighter.org. And the local citizens can actually find opportunities right in their local community to be able to provide volunteer services right to their local community. And it's not just about fighting fires anymore. There's all different opportunities within the local fire service and emergency service organizations.
What do the numbers tell us, Lieutenant, as far as how much of a decline in volunteer firefighters that we've seen in Michigan? Do we have an idea?
Well, we're still trying to gather that. And as I just took on the presidency role here in May, I've been out meeting with local fire departments across the state. I just was in Newaygo on Monday, and a couple weeks ago I was in Oceana County. I've been traveling to the east side of the state. And really the common theme with the chiefs and the members on fire departments is the same. We can't seem to find enough people, especially during the daytime. Many times communities used to allow the local volunteers to leave the workforce, and we're finding more and more people are not working in the same community where they're living. They're actually traveling a distance away, so they're not available during those daytime calls. And when someone's having a heart attack, or someone has a motor vehicle crash, or a structural fire, when they call 911, they're expecting that emergency services is going to arrive quickly and promptly, and they will arrive, but it may not be the closest organization that's actually responding just because of the lack of personnel. So what we're seeing is departments are actually pooling their resources, and during the daytime, rather than maybe one department responding, two, three, or even four area departments are responding together in what we call initial aid. So we're guaranteeing that we're going to get the fastest response and mitigate or correct whatever the emergency situation the citizen is facing.
Lieutenant, I'm interested. I think a lot of us don't know just exactly how volunteer firefighters fit into the scene. Are we talking about all volunteer departments, or are we seeing volunteers augmenting paid firefighters in the departments?
Well, we do have three different types of structures here in Michigan and across the country, all volunteer departments where they don't receive any form of compensation, paid on-call departments where they do receive a stipend for responding to calls, and then combination departments uses highly skilled paid career firefighters, as well as supplementing it with the paid on-call firefighters. We're seeing that becoming much more common. And then there are the all-career departments where they have fully staffed firefighters and emergency medical professionals who were able to respond to any type of emergency situation. One thing I'd like to mention is being a volunteer is not about what you look like, what degree you have, or where you come from. It's about one thing. Do you have heart and do you care about giving back to the community? And many times when I'm out talking with people, they don't realize that these opportunities are there. They assume their local fire department is fully staffed, that they have people that are in the building ready to respond 24 hours a day. And our paid on call and our volunteer firefighters many times are responding from home, or if they are allowed to respond from work, they have to go to the fire station and actually pick up the emergency equipment and then respond to that emergency situation.
When you talk about the all-volunteer departments as one of these forms, they, I'm sure, feel the shortage the most. You don't have a cushion of the paid full-time professional firefighters. Are there areas of Michigan, communities in Michigan, that tend to be more all-volunteer than others?
One close to Kalamazoo County, where I reside, is Pawpaw. It's still an all-volunteer fire department in Van Buren County. That is one that comes to mind. There are fewer and fewer all-volunteer departments, and more departments are at the paid-on-call level, where firefighters responding, emergency medical personnel responding, do receive some form of a stipend. Now, other states I've been following, like New York, Pennsylvania, they have actually implemented some recruitment and retention incentives where if you're on a fire department, a paid on call or a volunteer fire department, and you're on for a period of time, you may see a reduction in your property taxes, or you may see an incentive where the income that you receive through that volunteer organization is non-taxable. So those are some of the things we're continuing to look at, we're continuing to follow. It's not just a matter of putting the proverbial "we're looking for volunteer" signs out in the front yard of the fire station or the township hall or city hall. We need to get more creative, and we need to basically connect with our community and connect those resources together that are out there. We have people that are volunteering who actually have excellent opportunities to write grants for local fire departments, or they may want to go out and do public education in the schools, maybe a retired school teacher who has that background and that passion. So it's not just about fighting fires or responding to an emergency call. There's all different levels of service that we can look for those talents that are right in our local communities.
What about recruiting women?
Recruiting women continues to be a high priority. We are finding more and more women are getting into the fire service and emergency service organizations, and it's still primarily a male-dominated profession, but we're very excited about those opportunities and how we're able to better connect, especially when we're going out and we're doing the home safety visits and we're going out and checking on our older adults. We're able to connect better with our community because we're representing more of the diversity in our community right within our emergency services organization. So it's still a work in progress, but I'm very excited that we're matching how our community's demographics looks within our own organizations and many of our fire departments here in Michigan and across the country.
Lieutenant, Michigan is a leading state in this country for civilian home fire deaths. Do you worry about the shortage of volunteers? Is that contributing to this?
I wouldn't say it's contributing. What we're trying to do is we're trying to empower citizens to take action on their own and working certainly with advocates and other organizations who are already serving communities at large. It could be our Red Cross. It could be the Salvation Army, AARP, reaching out with the advocates that are already in the communities and connecting with the community to correct the right messaging out there. Certainly, there are opportunities for those who want to volunteer to help increase our advocacy and our outreach efforts. So we do look for more people to help with, for example, smoke alarm installations. We do get numbers of calls where older adults may not have the resources or the ability to install new smoke alarms in their homes. Smoke alarms need to be replaced every 10 years. That's one of the attributing factors to the high incident rate of fire deaths is we're going into homes that either don't have smoke alarms or the smoke alarms are well past the 10-year life expectancy, so they're non-operational, or the batteries have been taken out of those smoke alarms. Mm-hmm. The new alarms we've been installing in many of our communities have 10-year sealed batteries so that the alarms can't be tampered with, and they're worry-free technology so that our older adults and all families and all homes are well protected. And then also making sure we're focusing on practicing home fire escape plans. These are some of the things we've never really taught at the fire academy level, and we're really changing our focus. It's called community risk reduction. We're looking at all the hazards we either actually or potentially could be responding to, and then matching our needs and resources together to provide both the public and our fire service professionals with the knowledge, skills, and abilities to be able to connect better with their community and lower those fire fatalities. I'm pleased to say in West Michigan, the efforts have been really in a positive fashion. We've been launching this program in West Michigan now for about 4 years, and we're already seeing a 62% reduction in home fire deaths. So that's phenomenal. We want to take that model statewide and basically provide those needs and resources together and connect better with our community.
And in our last few moments here, Lieutenant, just kind of circling back to solving this problem of fewer volunteer firefighters, have you got a timeline in mind? Have you got some kind of a sense of what would it be to look like you've achieved success in recruiting volunteer firefighters?
Sure, Cindy. We're actually very excited about the MakeMeAFirefighter.org website because that's the first opportunity that we can connect a national resource right at the local level, and we can let people know through promotions that we do have these opportunities out there, and it's just a matter of clicking away on the internet and finding those local fire departments who are actually looking for those resources and connecting the two together. That's where the disconnect has really been, because the perception is every local fire department has people in the building 24 hours a day, and that's not necessarily the case. So we're trying to clear up those myths and misconceptions, and this is the first of those steps to be able to do this national advocacy at the local level, at the state level, to be able to increase our numbers and increase our efficiency and our effectiveness all throughout our communities, in every community in the state of Michigan.
Lieutenant Michael McLear, who is president of the Michigan State Firemen's Association. Thank you so much for talking with us, Lieutenant.
Thank you, Cindy.
Coming up, prosecutors and advocates are looking to take a new approach to curbing the scourge of domestic violence. We'll find out more after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What do you do when you keep trying to fix a problem and that fix just doesn't work over and over again? You try something different, that's what. Kalamazoo County today is unveiling a new approach it plans to use addressing those who commit domestic violence. The county is preparing to create a trauma court. This court would consider the past trauma and abuse the defendants may have suffered in their lives, operating under the idea that hurt people hurt people. With us now is Jeffrey Getting, who's the Kalamazoo County Prosecutor, and Jessica Glenn, who's Senior Director of Law and Policy for the Kalamazoo YWCA. Jeff, I want to start with you. Could you tell us, how would you describe the domestic violence problem in Kalamazoo County? Is it more than, less than, about the same as other counties in Michigan?
Well, I think that domestic violence is prevalent in Kalamazoo County, no different than any other community in Michigan or throughout the country. We see domestic violence as the most common form of violence in criminal prosecution and in our courts. I think that that's typical of any community. It's just really kind of an overwhelming problem, not just in Kalamazoo, but for everyone.
Jessica, how would you describe the way domestic violence affects the community in Kalamazoo? What do you see?
I would say that domestic violence across the country is a public health crisis. It's an epidemic. It has been for generations. I think that we've come a long way to thinking about ways to address it. I think that it has lost some of the stigma, although that remains in many communities and survivors coming forward. But it is a public health crisis.
And Jeff, I know you've announced, and we're going to talk about this so-called trauma court that you want to create to address domestic violence. Before we get into how it works and what it looks like, was there a specific case that really fired you up that got you thinking, okay, I need to do something different in the way we respond legally to these defendants?
There was a couple of instances of not just domestic violence, but homicides that were domestic in origin that happened in 2017 that really sort of pushed us into starting to talk about domestic violence in a different way and how we were going to approach perpetrators of domestic violence in order to try and stop this cycle of abuse that we were seeing. The case that really sort of pushed myself and others was happened in November of 2017 when Nicholas Mitchell killed Juliana Gibson, killed their son, Nicholas, who was 4 years old, and then killed himself. And, you know, when you have something like that happen and there's this huge hole, tear, rip in the community that's been caused by domestic violence, and there's no way of holding someone accountable. There's really no way of the system moving forward because the victims are dead, the perpetrator is dead, an innocent 4-year-old child is dead, and we're all standing there with the pieces and no way of putting it together again.
And thus, you have announced that you want to create this trauma court to address domestic violence. So tell us about how it would work, and particularly, how is it different from domestic violence courts, which already exist across the state and country?
There are a lot of domestic violence courts across the state, across the country, as you said, and they're doing really good work. They're expediting the flow of cases through the system. They're victim-centered and making sure that services are being provided to survivors. And there's this effort in holding perpetrators accountable. What we're talking about, though, when we talk about a trauma-focused court is in addressing those perpetrators differently than where we currently do. In Michigan, in Kalamazoo County, I'll use Kalamazoo County's numbers. In Kalamazoo County, we're going to prosecute approximately 1,000 domestic violence cases this year. About one-third of those cases, though, are repeat offenders. And so what we're doing for two-thirds of the offenses and putting persons on probation, maybe using a little bit of jail time, providing some services through a domestic assault intervention program are working. We're not seeing them come back. But we're seeing 300 offenders come back at a second, a third, a fourth, or subsequent time. And so what we're doing with those offenders isn't working. It becomes the idea of, instead of asking the question, what's wrong with you, start asking the question, what happened to you? And the idea of a trauma court is modeled on what we already know is successful through mental health courts, through veterans courts, through drug courts and sobriety courts. When we have offenders that are caught committing larcenies over and over and over again, most of the time, it's not a problem with stealing. Most of the time, there's this underlying issue of addiction. And if we deal with the addiction, then we don't have the crime continuing. It's the same idea with domestic violence and trauma. What we are finding is that perpetrators of domestic violence have been the victims of traumatic experiences throughout their life, beginning in their childhood, where they were witness to domestic violence, where they grew up in violent homes, violent communities, where they themselves have been the victims. And if we can instead ask what happened to you and start addressing those underlying traumas and building resiliency in the perpetrators, we can start to have an impact on whether or not they continue to victimize their partners or another partner down the road.
And I understand there was a report that you had done that looked into the correlations between youth violence and domestic violence in the Kalamazoo region. And some of what you just described were in the findings. What else did it find? What really jumped out at you?
Well, there were several findings in this study that Prevention Works worked with my office and other law enforcement agencies on that jumped out. And you see this correlation between domestic violence and youth violence. You see the correlation between age in the commission of domestic violence. We know that mostly we're dealing with younger offenders, persons between the ages 19 and 30. We know that domestic violence is a crime that occurs regardless of socioeconomic status, regardless of neighborhood, regardless of ethnicity, race, gender. All of those things are non-factors. Domestic violence is happening everywhere. But what we often see in the court system is cases that are coming from these same core lower socioeconomic neighborhoods where persons have fewer alternatives to turn to, where the police is the alternative. And so all of these things seem to push us to the same place, which is there's this core group of offenders that if we approach them differently, we can impact the outcomes of their cases in a different way.
Jessica Glenn, what do you think about the report's findings?
We at the YWCA participated in this study and provided information about the number of cases that we see, the number of sexual assault nurse exams given, the number of nights in shelter we provided to our community. I will say that socioeconomic status is not a protective factor when it comes to domestic violence. You know, Jeff has said that. We see more cases involving people who have low income within the criminal system, frankly, because those who enjoy a more privileged status or have a higher income do not call the police when there is domestic violence in their homes. The vast majority of clients that we have had, and I've been doing this work for over a decade, who are middle or upper middle class, and typically upper middle class, and engaged in professional, you know, positions, avail themselves of court remedies typically through the civil system. And it's typically being raised through divorce and custody cases. And that's a separate conversation in how those systems do not work for survivors of domestic violence. But the co-occurrence of family violence and youth violence, again, for youth who have been in a violent home and experienced domestic violence or child abuse or family violence, are more likely to become perpetrators or victims of domestic violence. We know this. We know this through three decades of research.
Hurt people hurt people.
That's exactly right. And so any initiative where we can address trauma is going to go a long way for our community. I think this is a great first bite at the apple. I think it's a great opportunity to address the underlying trauma in our community. But again, this is a start, and we hope it's the start to many more initiatives in our community.
If you just joined us, I'm speaking with Jessica Glenn, who's Senior Director of Law and Policy for the Kalamazoo YWCA, and with Jeff Getting, who's the Kalamazoo County Prosecutor, as we talk about a new solution in Kalamazoo County in terms of the cycle of violence we see with domestic violence, a trauma court. So, Jeff, on the ground, what would the trauma court do differently? Give us an idea.
Well, and it's important to point out that we're not there yet, right, in terms of there being a trauma court here in Kalamazoo, and we're continuing to work with our partners in the court system. They've expressed interest in this, and our local chief judge, Chris Henneke, is working with us as we further discuss this, as well as, you know, many partners sort of in the research area at Western's Medical School. At Michigan State University, Jim Henry at the Children's Trauma Assessment Center. And so as we talk with all of these partners about what would this look like, you know, what we need to have is some of the things that you see already in functioning domestic violence courts in terms of dedicated dockets and efficiency in how those proceedings are held. We need to have support of agencies like the YWCA and supporting the victims and maintaining a victim-centered approach in these prosecutions. We need support then also from the courts and the probation departments in terms of consequence. And that's really where this becomes different, is in terms of consequence. Because if what we're doing the first time somebody comes through the system with a probationary term, maybe a minute in jail, and the domestic assault intervention program isn't working, why in the world would we want to do it again? And so continuing this same ineffective intervention is getting us nowhere. And so what we need to do is we need to focus on doing assessments of the perpetrators to identify those underlying issues that are causing them to be perpetrators, identify those traumas throughout their life that haven't been dealt with, and focus on making sure that they are being dealt with in order to change behaviors in the perpetrators. We can't expect them to stop being violent just by putting them on probation. Doing that isn't changing the person, right? It's not changing the perpetrator. We have to do something to change the perpetrator, just like we've identified and done successfully throughout the country with drug courts. you know, with drug courts, what we're doing is identifying a person's underlying problem that's causing them to come into conflict with the system and then addressing that underlying problem. By dealing with their addiction, we cause them to stop committing crimes. We don't deal with the crime that they committed. We deal with their underlying problem. If we start looking at this differently and engaging in an assessment and identification of what the underlying problems are that the perpetrators have and those traumas that they've suffered that have caused them to become a perpetrator, then we can change the person rather than simply try to create fear of accountability, which isn't stopping anybody from engaging in these behaviors. The idea that the threat of being put on probation or the threat of going to jail for a week or a month is stopping this, I think, has been proven wrong time and time again. And I think Jessica will agree with me, as she said earlier, you know, we've seen this problem exist and continue to exist for decades. What we're doing isn't slowing down the train.
Jessica, I know the YWCA is on board with this, has been included in the discussions. What do you like about this idea of a trauma court?
So the reality is our current system isn't working. We see the vast majority of those who are perpetrating domestic violence continue down that path, either with their current victim or with another. And so addressing the root cause is compelling. We do know that where domestic violence courts have been implemented successfully throughout the country, recidivism has decreased. And we know that when both victims of domestic violence and perpetrators know the system is going to hold them to account, when there is procedural justice, when they think that the systems are fair and equitable and actually have teeth, that they're going to do something if you reoffend, the propensity to reoffend decreases. And so that is something that we are wholly in support of. We are excited to see where this goes. And I think our community is hungry for this.
Flip side, though, what gives you concern?
Well, I mean, the reality is that while we see 1,000 prosecutions a year, as Jeff alluded to, typically the result is a slap on the hand. And we have misdemeanor probation given in many cases where there was were strangulation, where there were really violent assaults on the victim. And so we want to make sure that at the center of this is accountability, and there remains accountability of those that offend, and victim safety is centered. I don't see that as an issue in this. I think this is an ongoing conversation about what those mechanics look like. And, you know, it needs not be said, but although domestic violence occurs within all relationships and all genders, anyone can be a perpetrator, the reality is that women's leading cause of death, the leading cause of death for women remains murder by an intimate partner. To be killed by your intimate partner is the leading cause of death, and that cannot ever fall away from this conversation and this initiative. And so victim survivor safety and family safety and their trauma needs to remain centered along with the offender's trauma.
Do you have any concern that the focus might be too much on giving perpetrators more chances at the expense of the safety of women?
I don't think we're there yet. I mean, okay. I think we're still talking about what this looks like. The prosecutor's office has been intentional in bringing the victim services movement in as partners. Along with the YWCA, they've been consulting with experts across the state and across the nation to really understand the dynamics of family and domestic violence. So, you know, we're working out the mechanics of what this looks like and hoping that we can get our judiciary on board.
In the final few moments we have to each of you, what would success of this trauma-based court look like? Jessica?
I think ultimately it's a decrease in the number of cases that are referred for prosecution for domestic violence. And I think there's no short-term solution to this. It's going to take a generation. But for the children of these families to get services for their parents, what we hope is that in a generation, we're going to see a radical decrease in the number of domestic violence cases as a community.
Yeah, I'd love to see fewer cases. What I'd love to see even more than fewer cases is fewer victims. Mm-hmm. You know, as Jessica alluded to or said earlier, there's a class of criminal cases and there's an additional group of victims that are seeking services all outside of that criminal justice system. If we could see 300 people at the Y instead of 500 people at the Y, that's what success looks like here.
Yeah. I mean, if I could work myself out of a job, I think that would be success. If there was no job as a victim services attorney in 20 years, I'd be quite pleased.
That was Jessica Glenn, who is the Senior Director of Law and Policy for the Kalamazoo YWCA, and also Jeffrey Getting, Kalamazoo County Prosecutor. Thank you for bringing us up to date on the work you're doing on this trauma court in Kalamazoo County.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on Stateside. In 2016, voters rejected a plan to improve public transit in Southeast Michigan. Well, there's a new one. We'll find out what's in that tomorrow. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.